Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and society. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. Our special guest is Eli Kintish, author of the book Hacking the Planet. In other words, is it possible that we can have a technical fix to global warming? Global warming is one of the main threats facing the world, but is it possible that technology can save the day? Well, we'll see. But anyway, let's summarize some of the top stories of the past week. One top story concerns, well, December 21st, Doomsday. Are we all going to die when the Mayan calendar expires on December 21st, or is it really just a figment of some overheated people's imagination? And then talking about some real threats to the planet, we're going to talk about the results of the latest conference in Qatar, Doha, results that are, in some sense, really catastrophic. Arctic sea ice, larger than the United States of America, melted this past year. Think about that. It's a tremendous amount of Arctic ice that simply vanished because of global warming. Not to mention the fact that the tundra is beginning to thaw out, which could have catastrophic implications for the climate of the world. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. You've probably been seeing a number of specials about doomsday survivalists who are selling their property, quitting their job, getting divorced, and heading off to the hills where they're going to essentially try to survive doomsday, December 21st, 2012, according to the Mayan calendar. Well, let's talk about some of the science behind the calendar and also some of the predictions. First of all, the Mayan calendar does, in fact, end one cycle on December 21st, 2012. But, hey, a new cycle begins. In fact, the calendars of many indigenous people are cyclical because they were so close to Mother Nature. And the ending of one cycle simply means the beginning of another. So in some sense, we should be rejoicing. We should be celebrating December 21st because in some sense, that's the beginning of New Year's on the Mayan calendar. Now, however, the tradition of the apocalypse is a Western tradition. And some people, I guess, saw gold in the hills. They could write books, be on television specials, and sell the story that December 21st is the end of everything, not just the end of one cycle. Let's talk about those predictions in detail now. Some people think there's a 10th planet out there that's going to come barreling down the solar system and destroy the Earth. First of all, if there was a planet like that that could destroy the Earth on December 21st, you'd be able to see it now. You look at the night sky and see an object perhaps brighter than the moon. But there is no such thing. In fact, scientists around the world, especially at Caltech, try to monitor things beyond the orbit of Pluto. And they find basically chunks of ice, small chunks of ice beyond the orbit of Pluto in what is called the Kuiper Belt of comets. There are objects out there that are about the same size as Pluto, but they're really, really far away, and they're very tiny, about the size of our moon, and they're certainly not posing a threat to the planet Earth on December 21st. Next, some people think there could be a pole shift. Well, the magnetic poles of the Earth do, in fact, migrate. And in fact, the magnetic field of the Earth is decreasing, but it takes many centuries to thousands of years for the magnetic poles to go to zero and then begin to migrate. So in other words, we're talking about cycles on the basis of 100,000 to millions of years in order to see any kind of pole shift of the magnetic field. And this is not the same thing as the geographical pole shift. If there was a geographical shift in the poles, well, that would literally tear the Earth in half if that were to happen. And next, some people think that we're going to be headed toward a black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. I don't think so. There is a black hole there, but it is 30,000 light years away. And there's no way that we could be swallowed up by a black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy by December 21st. You would have to go far beyond the speed of light in order to do that. And then if you saw the movie 2012, then the question is, well, do the planets line up? And will the gravitational field of all the planets rip up the Earth? And the answer is, well, the planets do line up, but they line up every few hundred years, and the Earth is still here. We've gone through many a cycle when the planets did, in fact, align. That's called the Jupiter effect. But even if the planets were all lined up in a row, they could not exceed the gravitational pull of the sun. And we're pulled by the sun every single second. And, hey, the Earth is still here. So the Jupiter effect is not going to rip up the Earth. And if you saw the movie 2012, you know that there's supposed to be a burst of neutrinos coming from the sun, and that then cooks the inside of the Earth, causing the pole shift. Well, you have to realize that neutrinos are some of the most ghost-like, elusive particles in the universe. If the entire solar system were made out of lead, neutrinos would go right through effortlessly. In fact, your body is being bombarded by billions of neutrinos even as we speak, and nothing happens. So, in other words, I wouldn't fear neutrinos. However, there is one thing to be concerned about. It's not going to cause doomsday on December 21st, but there is something that is a real threat, not this imaginary threat of a 10th planet or the Jupiter effect or neutrinos, and that is the threat of solar flares. We are headed toward the next cycle of the sun. Every 11 years, the sun has a temper tantrum. The North Pole and the South Pole of the sun do, in fact, flip every 11 years, causing a burst of radiation. Now, the threat is not toward doomsday, but the threat is toward causing a problem with our satellites and power stations. We are heavily dependent upon electromagnetism to power our cities and communications. And a gigantic solar flare from the sun, if it were to hit the Earth, could in fact fry our satellites, wipe out television, radio, GPS, internet, and short-circuit power stations, not just in one city, but in literally thousands of cities across the planet Earth, power could be wiped out. Such an event actually did happen back in 1859, called the Carrington Effect. But hey, back then we didn't have satellites. We didn't have television, radio, we didn't have radar, we didn't have GPS, and we certainly didn't have power plants energizing our homes. So in fact, these solar cycles have happened ever since antiquity and before. For billions of years, we've had these solar cycles. The problem is, however, only in the last few cycles have we had satellites, have we had the internet, power stations. Now, the American Physical Society, of which I'm a member, is the largest organization of physicists in the United States. Our membership is about 30,000. And we pleaded to the United States Congress to give us peanuts, a few hundred million, to reinforce satellites, build redundant safety systems. But unfortunately, the Congress simply laughed at us and gave us not a dime. So in other words, we are sitting ducks to a potential hurricane from outer space. Now, again, the probability of it happening is small. The last great event was back in 1859 when we were at just the beginning of the electric age. Nobody knows. Nobody knows when the next cycle could peak. And speaking about imaginary threats to the Earth, think now about real threats to the planet Earth. Just this past week in Doha, in Qatar, in the Middle East, there was a meeting of environmentalists sponsored by the United Nations talking about a sum up of where we are with regards to global warming. And the results of that talk were not optimistic at all. One scientist got up there and said that Arctic sea ice melt just in the past year was larger than the surface area of the United States of America. This is incredible. The North Pole, where Santa Claus is supposed to live, from March to September, lost a staggering 11.83 million square kilometers of ice, an area bigger than the United States. Now, it is cyclic. It comes and goes, but the swings are getting very large, so large that we're essentially missing ice that is comparable to the size of the United States of America. This is amazing. Now, realize that just in the past 50 years, we've had submarines that have visited the North Pole and measured the thickness of sea ice. the thickness has dropped in the past 50 years by 50%. So in other words, just within the last 50 years, at the rate of 1% per year, we've lost Arctic sea ice. So much so that in summertime, in fact, if you were to look at the North Pole from outer space, there is no ice at all. So in other words, there are times when we simply have lost all the ice at the North Pole. This new report, however, is much worse, because now the total amount of area lost by the Arctic is larger than the United States of America. Now, of course, it fluctuates, so during wintertime, some of the ice comes back. However, this has set a new record, according to the United Nations. Then there was yet another speaker talking about a runaway greenhouse effect. Most of the carbon in the Earth is not really in the atmosphere at all. It's in the tundra. In the tundra, we see vegetation that died perhaps thousands of years ago, frozen since that time. And if the ice were to thaw out, we're talking about huge amounts of methane gas and carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. That could set off a runaway chain reaction. First, we have global warming melting the ice, releasing the vegetation of the tundra to release methane and carbon dioxide. That heats up the planet. That, in turn, accelerates the melting of the permafrost, and the cycle starts all over again. So the more tundra you melt, the more methane and carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere, which means you have more melting of the tundra. And Siberia has an enormous amount of tundra locking the methane, carbon dioxide, and carbon intact. However, if Siberia and Canada, northern Canada and Alaska were to thaw out, we're talking about huge quantities of carbon dioxide that could then make its way into the atmosphere, causing havoc. And in fact, you've probably seen some science specials about the fact that scientists are reclaiming mammoths in the Arctic at a very large rate. Why is it that frozen mammoths, mammoths that were frozen tens of thousands of years ago, are the subject of so many science specials? And the answer is the tundra is thawing out. And with the thawing out of the tundra, it means that animals which died tens of thousands of years ago in the Arctic are now slowly beginning to thaw out. This is cause for a tremendous amount of concern, because it means that in the future, we could have a runaway greenhouse effect. And also in the news, black holes are dominating the headlines in astronomy magazines. It turns out that scientists have found one of the biggest black holes in the universe just this past week. Now, fortunately, it is 200 million light years from Earth, so there's no way that it's going to affect us on December 21st. However, this black hole weighs 17 billion times the mass of our sun. Let me repeat that again. Take our sun, multiply by 17 billion, and you now get a feeling for how big this black hole is. This black hole is so big that it makes up about a third of the mass of the entire galaxy. Now, our black hole is puny by comparison. Our black hole only makes up perhaps 0.1% of the mass of the Milky Way galaxy, but it is already a few million times the mass of our sun. This giant black hole, discovered just this past week, weighs over 17 billion times the mass of the sun, and it forces us to reconsider the evolution of galaxies and the evolution of black holes if we can have monsters like this that weigh 17 billion times the mass of the sun. So in other words, the universe is turning out to be a lot stranger than we originally thought, and black holes, which were once considered to be science fiction, once considered to be as rare as the unicorn, we now find them everywhere we look at the center of galaxies. But not only this, we now have monster black holes that weigh 17 billion times the mass of our sun, setting new astronomical records. And again, let me emphasize, there's no threat that we're going to fall into a black hole on December 21st, 2012. That's just science fiction. In fact, the Earth would have to travel at the speed of light for millions of years in order to get even close to a black hole, and that's not going to happen.
Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. You know, it was Mark Twain who once said, "Everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it." Well, that was a joke 150 years ago, of course, because what can you do about the weather after all? And if the weather is going to go berserk in the future with global warming, then the question is, are there technical fixes? Geoengineering is a word that sounds like a contradiction in terms. The Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter. It's huge. It's humongous. And engineering requires that humans intervene with our machines. So how can our machines possibly change the entire Earth? The damage we've done by spewing out tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide has set off effects in the atmosphere that seem to be irreversible. But are they? Well, our special guest today is Eli Kentish. He's a reporter for Science Magazine. He's written for Slate, Discover, and The New Republic, and his new book is called Hack the Planet. Science's best hope or worst nightmare for averting climate catastrophe. So in this hour, we're going to talk about some of the most imaginative and some of the most harebrained crackpot schemes that scientists and engineers have devised to save the planet using an untested technology called geoengineering. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in science as a youth?
Well, I think it was watching Mr. Wizard on television as a kid. I really enjoyed the experiments that Mr. Wizard did with his children that were guests on the show. And I guess just being raised in a household where I was encouraged by my father to, you know, play with chemical sets or to collect rocks or go out into the forest and go hiking. I guess just a general sense of exploration as a child made me interested in science.
And how did you first get interested in the idea of writing a book called Hack the Planet?
Well, for my in my day job, I work at Science Magazine, and I didn't know what the word geoengineering was until 2007, only 3 years ago, when I went to this really striking meeting at Harvard University, which I describe in the book. In that meeting, we all thought the sort of established top scientists in climate change would dissuade this kind of fringe group from studying geoengineering because it was considered almost uncouth to think about these wild schemes. But on the contrary, what happened at that meeting in 2007 was that some very distinguished senior scientists decided that the severity of the climate challenge requires us to think about these radical methods, and the geoengineering clique, as I describe them in my book, got the blessing instead of being shunned.
Okay. Now, in your book, you lay out four possible scenarios. And these are, well, worst-case scenarios. Some people think they'll never happen or they'll happen maybe in 100 years, but you take them seriously. So lay out these four scenarios and the implications and the likelihood.
Well, the worst-case scenarios I describe are each probably unlikely, but one of the challenges is we don't know their likelihood. It's only in the last decade or so that climate scientists have started to think about these so-called tipping points. One of them, which gets probably the most attention, is large-scale melting of the poles. And we've seen that sea ice is disappearing faster than scientists expected only 5 years ago. That's the ice that forms on the surface of the ocean. It's disappearing mostly in the Arctic, although it's okay in the Antarctic. But the ice sheets, which sit on Greenland and both sides of Antarctica, are disintegrating faster than models suggested only a few years ago. And the Arctic is the fastest warming place on Earth as the dark ocean, as the white ice is replaced with dark ocean, and that ocean absorbs heat. And so scientists are really in the dark about how fast the poles could disintegrate because the models they use to predict are really shown to be outdated, and the system is moving faster than they can respond to.
Now, the Arctic ice near the North Pole is gone by about 50% if you look at submarine data taken from the 1950s and now, about a 50% thinning. But what about the South Pole? Most of the water is in the South Pole.
Right. For a while, there was hope that the South Pole would be stable. But in recent years, they've found that, yes, the South Pole is losing mass in the same way that Greenland has. I mean, Greenland is further south and closer to the equator, so it gets more heat. But unfortunately, they're starting to find that Greenland is showing signs of more sensitivity than they feared. Excuse me, that Antarctica is showing more signs of sensitivity than they feared.
And isn't there also a runaway effect? As you mentioned, the less ice there is, the less sunlight is reflected back into outer space, which causes more global warming, which causes less ice. Isn't there a runaway effect?
That's why they consider the disintegration of the poles a so-called tipping point or feedback, because the fear is that at some point in the future, as the temperature, if the temperature passes some certain unknown threshold, that the feedback effect, as you describe it, would sort of create a runaway warming. You'd have melting ice, more black water, more melting ice, more black water. It's also, despite the crazy schemes in my book, it's unclear that there's actually a way to reverse, the disintegration of the ice sheets on a large scale.
And
just too much inertia in the system.
And doesn't this also mean that at a certain point, some of the great cities of the Earth could be underwater by maybe mid-century or perhaps late in the century?
It's unclear how fast the ice sheets would disintegrate. The ice on the surface of the ocean doesn't affect sea level because, like an ice cube in a glass, as it melts, it maintains the level of the ice, the level of the water in the glass stays the same. But the ice that's sitting on land, the three ice sheets, would affect sea level rise. And right now, it's only a slight effect, although it's rising. But the fear is that it could accelerate in the future. And there are, of course, billions of people and some of the most vulnerable people in the world, especially in Southeast Asia, who would be facing real crises from melting ice. I should also mention that it's not just the ice sheets that are vulnerable. We've already seen thousands and thousands of glaciers in the mountains disappear or disintegrate, and that could lead to ice to real shortages in the future of water for people who need it.
Okay, and your second scenario is mega droughts. Could you elaborate?
One thing we know about previous changes in the Earth's climate in the past is that some of these changes have been associated with these mega droughts, and scientists now consider the Dust Bowl, which occurred obviously in the 1930s in the United States, as a climatic effect, and something which could happen in the future. Scientists just don't know what sort of effects it could have. But even if we didn't have the droughts, the shortage of water, just the rise of temperature could affect agriculture very substantially. Scientists know that with every degree Fahrenheit temperature rise, crops lose as much as 5 or 10% of their yield, including major grain crops like corn or rice. And so, it's really the implications for agriculture in a warming world are really frightening, not only a world with drier conditions in certain places.
And the next scenario is methane release. Could you elaborate?
There's many, many billion. We emit about 8 billion tons of carbon a year in man-made activities, but there's much, much more carbon locked up in various forms in the permafrost as well as in the deep ocean. And that's carbon mostly held as methane, which is a greenhouse gas much more potent than carbon dioxide. And so the fear is that as the temperature of the Earth rises, that frozen carbon would be released, creating yet another sort of runaway effect, as you describe it.
Yeah, and so more methane, more global warming, more tundra being melted, thawing out all this vegetation that was frozen thousands of years ago. And then you talk about what could happen to the ocean currents. Could you elaborate?
Right. The reason that Europe sits some 10 degrees, you know, major cities in Europe like London sit some 10 degrees latitude further north than, you know, Boston or New York. And the reason, though, they've got a fairly temperate climate is because warm water from the equator is brought by the global conveyor, which moves around the world's ocean. And there's evidence in the past that this conveyor, which delivers warm water to Europe as well as drives countless climate systems around the world, there's evidence that in the past this conveyor has been shut down. Specifically, as the balance of salty and fresh water has changed. And so there's fear that as the fresh water locked up in the ice sheets is delivered into the ocean, it might shut down the conveyor. And the last time this happened, I believe it was some tens of thousands of years ago, there was total chaos on Earth, and I describe it in my book.
So we're talking about a mini ice age that's set off, ironically, by global warming, right?
Right. The movie The Day After Tomorrow, which came out four or five years ago, described this. It showed ice covering, you know, North America and Europe, just a mini ice age related not to the global temperature per se, but simply to the distribution of heat around the planet because this conveyor, this global ocean conveyor, allows areas, you know, northern and southern areas to get warm from the center of the planet.
Well, that concludes the first part of our interview with Eli Kintish, author of the book Hacking the Planet. If you want to learn more about the future of energy, the future of the world, in fact, get a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years. How will jobs, biotechnology, medicine, computers, robotics affect our life? Get a copy because it's a New York Times bestseller. So once again, my latest book is called Physics of the Future, about the next 100 years in science and technology. The book, Physics of the Future, is now number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. And go to my website, mkaku.org, and it gives you the cities that I'll be speaking in, signing autographs of the book. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Eli Kintish. He's a reporter for Science Magazine and the author of an interesting book called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe.
You know, some people, when they hear about global warming, simply roll their eyes up and says, oh, what's the use? It's too late. We've gone past the point of no return. We're doomed. Doom and gloom is all we get. Other people say, well, let's be proactive. Let's do something about it. Maybe we haven't hit the point of no return. We can change our lifestyle. We can lobby Congress. We can do things about it. We can save the planet. And then you have a third response. And the third response is, well, maybe we can engineer our way out of the crisis. Maybe science has helped to create the problem, but maybe science can also give us a solution to the problem. Well, the problem is pretty severe, and the Earth is huge, and our engineering abilities are rather primitive. So some of these schemes may sound a bit outlandish. Other people say, well, hey, what else are we going to do? Just sit back, roll over, and die? So let's take it seriously. Hack the Planet. That's the book. And we're going to continue our interview now with Eli Kintish of Science Magazine. Okay, so these are the doom and gloom scenarios. And again, they're worst-case scenarios. However, now let's talk about geoengineering, which on the surface sounds like a contradiction in terms. But let's talk about the first thing that comes to mind. If carbon dioxide is a problem, well, on the Earth, carbon dioxide is regulated by life. Life loves carbon dioxide and converts it into oxygen, plant life in particular, algae, for example. So what about using life to combat global warming?
The planet, as I said, you know, humans emit some 8 billion tons of carbon a year by burning fossil fuels and other types of emissions, like cutting down the rainforest. But many more than 8 billion tons of carbon are taken up every year by the planet's own carbon sinks, forests and marine life, like you said, like algae and microorganisms. And so there are ways to imagine enhancing the planet's own carbon sink by growing giant algae blooms, for example, to take in some of the excess carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. And there's estimates that if we were to do, if we were to grow algae blooms on a massive scale, say around Antarctica, where there are plenty of nutrients but little life, you might be able to take up as much as 1 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere each year. The problem is, of course, that we don't know what some of the side effects of intentionally growing algae blooms would be. We can do it fairly easily because in some places, there's, like I said, there's plenty of nutrients in the water, but a certain trace nutrient, iron, is missing. And so a number of experiments have shown that when you sprinkle a dilute solution of iron into the ocean, you can grow algae on a mass scale. But scientists don't know what the effects of doing this year after year over large areas of the ocean might be.
Is there a possibility of a runaway effect there? For example, so-called Africanized killer bees were introduced into Latin America as an experiment, and they have since more or less taken over all the bee populations of Latin America. They're now entering into Texas and California, and so this was an experiment gone amok. You cannot recall a life form. So what about the problem of a runaway effect with these algae experiments?
There's a number of disturbing side effects that these algae experiments might cause. They might create large areas of the ocean devoid of oxygen, so-called dead zones. You might grow algae that's toxic. And a paper recently suggested that some of the algae grown in these early experiments on this idea had high levels of toxic proteins. You might create a situation where, as you create this algae bloom, the ecosystem that you create, sort of below this algae bloom, includes microorganisms that emit greenhouse gases. So you'd be taking in carbon, which is a substantial but a fairly a kind of standard greenhouse gas, and actually emit a greenhouse gas that's more potent and has an even greater warming effect. So you have to be careful what you grow, and there's a lot more science that needs to be done before anyone could consider doing this on a large scale. As for runaway effects, my book is full of examples of previous efforts by scientists to try to alter environments on large scale, and a lot of them go wrong, precisely because scientists don't always know what effects their interventions might have.
And also, Professor Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton has earned the ire of some people by saying that global warming has been exaggerated, but he does say that the Earth is warming and that one way to counteract that problem is with genetic engineering, specifically genetically engineered trees that are specifically designed to maximally take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's a number of ways to, again, enhance the planet's important sort of carbon sink function right now, and that could be by growing different kinds of plants, by enhancing the plants we have now. I mean, one idea is actually to grow certain prairie grasses, which take up an amazing amount of carbon in their roots below the surface, much better than most weeds, which have very little carbon below the surface because they want to grow fast instead of for the long haul. And so, yes, there are various ideas about genetically modifying plants to take up carbon. There are also ideas to make plants shinier, because if you can make the planet more reflective in some of these more far-out schemes, you would reflect solar radiation away from the planet. So if you can make leaves shinier, some scientists have thought of actually making forests more reflective, because one of the risks with growing forests to take in carbon dioxide, Professor, is that you actually take a light-colored surface, maybe, ground, and put something dark on it. So you may be taking carbon, but you're actually making it more absorbing of solar radiation.
And some people have advocated pollution, deliberately creating pollution, like what happened with Mount Pinatubo, the volcano which erupted and caused the Earth to cool, because then volcanic ash reflects sunlight back into outer space. And the recent Icelandic eruption is expected to reduce in a tiny way the temperature of the Earth. So what about deliberately polluting the atmosphere?
Well, the Pinatubo example is a great one. In 1991, this volcano, which is in the Philippines, spewed some 10 billion tons of sulfur into the atmosphere. And those tons, sulfur pollution made it was forced out at such a massive pressure that it got up into the stratosphere, the high atmosphere above the weather. And there it stayed for about a year, and the planet's temperature went down about 1 degree Fahrenheit. You can see it on temperature measurements. The Icelandic volcano was much weaker and released about 6,000 times less pollution. And so it's unlikely that, like you said, would have much of a discernible effect. The idea with what I call the Pinatubo option in my book is that you would mimic this cooling effect that volcanoes have naturally, and you would do that by releasing the same kind of things, these sulfate particles, into the stratosphere, or maybe another particle which you find has fewer side effects. One of the problems with putting sulfate particles into the stratosphere is that you can destroy ozone, and ozone is a key part of the atmosphere because it protects us from ultraviolet radiation. And the more stuff that's up there, we've found, the more natural processes come into play to destroy the ozone.
Well, one of the scientists who actually was in on the research on the ozone problem and won the Nobel Prize for it has advocated that we create a doomsday machine. A doomsday machine would only be used as we approach doomsday with the worst effects of global warming. And the doomsday machine would have rockets, large numbers of rockets, which would deliberately go into the stratosphere and dump these pollutants into the atmosphere to create an artificial Mount Pinatubo. What are your thoughts about this, a doomsday machine?
Well, you don't really even need rockets. I mean, rockets might get, particles up into the stratosphere quickly, but all you really need is a balloon and a garden hose, to be honest. You might need a number of them because you have to spread the particles around properly. But, you know, one of the fears about the Pinatubo option, as I call it, is that it's relatively cheap. And, you know, this has become something of almost a proliferation risk, because say it costs $1 billion or $2 billion a year to maintain this sort of regimen of sulfate injections up into the stratosphere. Maybe a billionaire decides that he's tired of all the dithering on carbon dioxide, and he wants to cool the planet directly. And so he might deploy his own Pinatubo option. Maybe it's unlikely, but maybe a small state, you know, facing the worst effects of global warming would decide in the future. And so scientists are starting to think of geoengineering as a new global security risk.
Okay, now to change the subject slightly, you don't really mention it in your book, but there's the option of coal sequestration. That is, coal-fired plants produce copious quantities of carbon dioxide. So even if you have a hybrid, the hybrid in turn gets its electricity from a coal plant, which creates tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide. So some people have said, well, why don't we deep six the carbon dioxide, store it underground? And there's an experiment going on right now to see if it's economical to extract the carbon dioxide from a coal plant and inject it underground. Any thoughts?
There are a number of experiments around the world using the carbon dioxide created from natural gas or oil exploration. And now, as you said, there's one in Ohio looking at, you know, large-scale carbon sequestration from coal plants. The climate conundrum really starts and ends with coal. We're not going to be able to maintain the lifestyle we have in this country right now without coal, and certainly developing countries look to coal as the fastest way for them to get energy, specifically India and China. And so we have to find a way to make coal a more carbon-friendly fuel source. And what's needed, as you said, are these massive efforts to take the carbon dioxide that otherwise would have been put into the sky and put it essentially back where the carbon came from, in the ground. And this would be a massive endeavor. And right now, the cost estimates are somewhere between $50 and $80 per ton of carbon dioxide, which would increase everyone's fuel bills, electricity bills. And as you say, you know, even if you drive a hybrid car, that electricity for the car has to come from somewhere. And so while carbon sequestration for coal plants is probably not a geoengineering idea, it's going to be a big part of our energy system if we're going to be able to live sustainably in terms of our climate.
And what about the possibility of an accident? And all of a sudden, all this carbon dioxide suddenly is injected into the atmosphere after being stored underground. Any thoughts about that?
That they inject carbon dioxide as a matter of course all throughout Texas and in other places where you're trying to get oil out of wells. That hasn't happened, although there have been a couple of notable natural releases of carbon dioxide. But the geologists are looking closely at that risk, Professor, and you know, they are concerned about it. So far, most of the geologists that I interview have told me that it's not really a major risk, but I would say that if there was to be an accident like that, even if it didn't kill anybody, that would be a big, big setback for this effort to make coal more sustainable from a climate perspective.
Now, also, let's get a little bit into some of the harebrained schemes. In the past, the CIA looked into the possibility of geoengineering during the Vietnam War. That is, using silver iodide or seeding the clouds with crystals that would then form nuclei for water vapor and would help to induce the monsoon season in order to drown out any guerrilla offensive in Vietnam. Well, that was a catastrophic failure. Modifying the weather has always been something that armies, dictators, and statesmen have looked at, but nothing's ever come of it, or has it? What about the possibility of weather modification?
Well, actually, this is a billion-dollar industry around the world. I mean, the Chinese are facing a massive drought in their southeast areas, and they've actually, in the last few months, deployed one of the biggest weather modification, campaigns ever done. But really, I mean, hundreds of companies around the U.S. in hundreds of places do weather modification every year. Scientists are not sure it works. In some places, it probably does work. In other places, it probably doesn't. It's hard to know whether the rain you get one day may mean no rain next week, and if the rain you get in one place may not be that the guys next door aren't getting. And so weather modification is something that is happening despite the fact that scientists can't prove that it works.
So we don't know whether or not we're monkeying with Mother Nature correctly, or it could boomerang against us, right, at some point.
There have been a couple of court cases where weather modification experiments were followed by floods, and people died. And it's hard to connect one thing to the other. I don't think anyone's ever been found guilty in court of negligence for such an experiment. But you know, in some places in the West, they really welcome weather modification because they want any rain they can get. But yes, it's really difficult to connect the effects of an experiment with the actual consequences we see in nature. In fact, you know, if we were to do this Pinatubo option, putting particles up into the stratosphere, Professor, it may be unclear what the effects would be, because to do it on a large enough scale so that you could tease out the signal from the noise, so to speak, you might be doing essentially global geoengineering. And so the line between experiment and actual deployment becomes fuzzy.
And I guess there's always the unintended side effects. For example, in China, they have a gigantic dam that is near an earthquake fault, and water will, in fact, grease the tectonic plates and induce earthquakes. And so there's concern that a recent earthquake was, in fact, artificially induced by water being injected into the tectonic plates because of the building of a dam. Well, you've looked at a lot of proposals. What are some of the more harebrained schemes being touted out there that maybe have no chance of ever seeing reality?
Well, some of the favorites are ideas which the Soviets came up with in the 50s and 60s. Now, we're thinking about geoengineering now because we're worried about the side effects of this global warming. But in the 50s and 60s, the Soviets were thinking about improving a cold climate, as they thought of it. And so they thought of putting giant Saturn rings into orbit above the Earth that would somehow reflect light onto the planet, or diverting water from the northern Atlantic, which is warmer water, into the Arctic Ocean to melt Siberia or the Arctic. And then there are ideas more modern of actually putting spacecraft between the Earth and the Sun to divert, say, maybe 2% of solar radiation away from the planet. And that would cool the planet off, obviously, directly. Also, concepts of brightening sea clouds, because that mimics a natural phenomenon that particles brighten the clouds above the ocean, as well as recently a scientist suggested making man-made whitewater. And so when you see whitewater at the shore or in a river, that's tiny bubbles, and that's actually more reflective than dark water, which doesn't have the bubbles in it. And so the idea would be to create massive swaths of these tiny bubbles in places where you want to cool the ocean or the planet.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the option of using space satellites, as you mentioned, to generate electricity. The Japanese are looking into it, and PG&E in California, believe it or not, is actually looking into it seriously, using space satellites to beam energy back down to the planet Earth. Well, you've looked at all these options. What do you think is really going to happen? I mean, you live on this planet. You have friends and family here. You're going to be affected, not just as a journalist, but as a human being. What do you think is going to happen, and what do you think is the best option that you've looked at among all these options?
I think what's going to happen in the future is if we are unlucky and the planet is on the more sensitive side to all the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere, I think that there could be some pretty desperate moves by countries or even, like I said, individuals to try to cool the planet, to avoid some of the worst-case effects. And we don't know what sort of effects those desperate moves could take or what they might be. They could be to try to cool the planet. They could be to try to take carbon out of the atmosphere on a massive scale. We don't know. But I think it's important for scientists and governments to start to think about these worst-case, these geoengineering techniques, because we need to find a way to talk about them and regulate both their experiments on them as well as, you know, actually using them. I mean, I think the most important thing to do is to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Unfortunately, though, it's unclear that even if we halted emissions tomorrow, the planet's temperature would continue to rise because of the thermal inertia of the oceans, as well as the fact that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for hundreds and thousands of years. And what? So we may, I think it's actually crucial that we study these very disturbing methods of cooling the planet, because in the future, the way to eliminate, to reduce suffering may be to try them.
Well, your book is called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. Well, you still didn't answer the question. Is it going to be science's best hope or will it be the worst nightmare? That is, if you're going to put money on the table after looking at all these different options, which one do you think has the best chance of succeeding, or perhaps we should try another approach entirely?
I guess for me, we just don't have enough information. I don't mean to be elusive, but we've done almost no scientific studies of any of these options. A handful of modeling studies on the Pinatubo option, a few small-scale ocean experiments for growing the algae. We know there are natural analogs to many of these attempts, but we just haven't tried them in the same way that we've tried, you know, other engineering options that would help us live more sustainably, like, for example, the sequestering of carbon for coal plants. I mean, the main thing I think we need to do is to do science on this stuff while cutting our emissions aggressively. And that's because you're asking me as a journalist to put money on the table to bet on these options. Well, in 30 or 40 years, we may have to bet a lot more than one reporter's money. We may have to try something because we face a crisis, and we don't have enough information to make an informed decision yet.
And what do you say, though, to those people who believe that perhaps none of these options are going to work because the planet is huge and previous attempts have always failed, that the real emphasis is conservation, is going solar, is going to the electric car, the hybrid, looking at renewable technologies, the long, hard process of creating alternative fuels and conservation. So what do you say to those people?
Well, first of all, that is the most important thing right now. It is to change the way we use and produce energy is the most important thing, more important than studying geoengineering techniques. But you said, you know, that efforts to alter the planet have always failed, and I'm not so sure that's the case. I mean, there are certainly many examples of humans screwing up this planet. I mean, even just trying to encourage people in this country to grow biofuels by growing corn has led to, you know, food shortages in Mexico, and that's a pretty simple example. And so obviously it's far-fetched to think if we can't grow biofuels sustainably that we're going to be able to hack the clouds or alter the ocean in a wise way. That said, you know, we may cut our emissions tomorrow. I mean, you and I probably would agree that that's unlikely, but even if we were to cut emissions, we still may face a situation of mass suffering just because we're so far down this road already. And because of that, I think we have no choice but to think about these radical notions and try to figure out if any of them are realistic.
Okay, final question. Do you have anything to say to those listeners who may want to pick up a copy of your book, now hitting the bookstands, Hack the Planet, science's best hope or worst nightmare for averting climate catastrophe?
Yeah, the book's gotten great reviews, and I think the reason is that it's both informative and a fun read, full of wild characters and wacky ideas and real story of where we are as a species on this planet.
Well, we've run out of time, and once again, our special guest has been Eli Kintish. The book is called Hack the Planet. Well, in the remaining time on exploration, let me make an editorial comment, and that is, in my personal opinion, I say, why not? Why not look at these different alternatives, all the way from the reasonable and scientifically sound, all the way to the outlandish and perhaps even impossible? We should look at all different options, but we should not put our egg in the geoengineering basket. These options are very risky, very expensive, and we simply don't know if they're going to work. The main energy should go to energize ourselves to change our lifestyle, change our politicians, change our political and energy strategy so that we go in the direction of conservation, in the direction of renewable technology, in the direction of solar power, wind power, and all the different energy options. Now, personally, I believe that the cost of solar hydrogen keeps dropping every year, while the cost of fossil fuels, on average, rises every year, and the two curves will eventually cross. We don't know when, perhaps 10 years or so. And when the two curves cross, then market forces enter the picture, and then it becomes economical for even the heavy hitters in the energy industry to go solar, to go hydrogen, and that could initiate a sea change without having to geoengineer the planet. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest was Eli Kintish. He's a journalist with Science Magazine, and he's the author of a new book called Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.